My grandmother and my mother used to say that dreams come from an unknown area of heaven, far, far away, and they descend to earth when men call them. They could bring pain or comfort, joy or desperation, or sometimes they have no meaning and bring nothing. But it's not necessarily true that only bad men receive evil dreams and silly men empty ones. Who are we, after all, to understand the ways of heaven? What's really bad, my grandmother would say, is to receive no dreams. It's like not receiving the warmth of someone who's thinking of us, even if they're far away. I hadn't dreamed for months. I suspect many of us had stopped dreaming, but we were afraid to admit it. We felt so alone in the mornings, so we invented them, and they were always lovely dreams, full of light and color and memories of home. We competed to see who could invent the most fantastic ones, speaking very fast with full mouths until the mistress said, "Enough already, enough." When we were allowed to pass one by one behind the filthy curtain that hid the Turkish toilet at the back of the big room where our looms and benches stood in rows. The first ones to go were the ones who had slept chained by their ankles to their looms. The masters called them numbskulls because they worked slowly and poorly. They got the colored yarns mixed up or made mistakes in the pattern, the worst possible error, or they cried too loudly over the blisters on their fingers. The numbskulls weren't very bright. Everybody else knew that. All you had to do is take the knife we use for working and cut open the blister. The liquid drips out, and it hurts for a while, but in time the skin grows back to get tougher, so you don't feel anything anymore. You just have to know how to bear the weight. Those of us who weren't chained sometimes felt sorry for the numbskulls, but sometimes we teased them. Usually they were the new workers that just arrived who hadn't learned that the only way we could become free was to work very hard and very fast, to erase each and every line in our small slates until there were none left, and we could return home. Like the others, I had my own little slate hanging above the loom I worked on. The day I arrived, many years before, Hussein Khan had taken a clean slate and had made signs on it. "This is your name." "Yes, sir." "This is your slate. Nobody could touch it. Do you understand?" "Yes, sir." Then he drew many other lines, one next to the other, as straight as the hair on the back of a frightened dog, and every group of four had a line through it. "Can you count?" the master asked. "Almost up to 10," I responded. "Look," Hussein Khan said, "this is your debt. Every line is a rupee. I'll give you a rupee for every day you work." "That's fair. Nobody would pay you more. Ask anyone you want. Everyone will say that Hussein Khan is a good and fair master who gives you what you deserve, and every day at sunset I'll erase one of these lines right in front of your eyes. You'll feel proud, and your parents will feel proud, because it'll be the fruit of your work. Do you understand?" "Yes, sir," I answered. But it wasn't true. I hadn't understood. I studied those mysterious lines, thick as trees in a forest, but I couldn't distinguish my name from the debt. It was as though they were the same thing. "When all the lines are erased," Hussein Khan said, added, "when you see the slate wiped completely clean, when you'll be free and you'll be able to return home." I never saw a clean slate, neither mine nor one of my companions.